The Rich Inner Life of the Introvert.
I really set out to write a woman's life, a woman who's very introverted and fairly quiet, but it doesn't mean she is passive. You know, I consider Tess to have a very vibrant inner life. She doesn't always mediate the outer world very well.
That's Mary Costello talking about the protagonist of her novel, Academy Street. Then, in light of this week's Supreme Court decision declaring Texas's restrictive law on abortion clinics unconstitutional, we re-air our 2015 interview with Katha Pollitt about her book, Pro. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It is perhaps a banal observation that we live our lives on the inside far differently than the selves we project to others. Mary Costello's debut novel, Academy Street, illuminates this internal self in her spare and moving portrait of the novel's protagonist, Tess. Academy Street follows Tess from her early childhood in Western Ireland through her relocation to New York as a nurse, single mother, and retiree, ending finally with a family reunion at her brother's funeral back in Ireland. The novel opens with a signal event, the loss of Tess's mother at the age of 7. The shock renders her mute for several years, but even after she recovers her speech, she cannot shake the sense of standing apart from others. It's as if she's lost the power to communicate her inner self. Throughout her life, she carries forward a kind of social muteness. Yet her inner life is rich, filled with tender observations of the minute details of existence, the flight of a bird, a visit to a museum. Largely undistracted by relationships, she's free to train her attention inward to examine her own feelings and her reactions to the external world. As Tess grows older and then old, a deep sense of connection to life as it is lived blossoms, despite, or perhaps even because, of the repeated losses she experiences. Over the 7 decades the novel covers, a portrait emerges of a woman who trods a solitary path, beginning in fear and confusion, and ending with a measure of peace and wisdom. Mary Costello's first book was a story collection, The China Factory, published in 2012. Academy Street is published by Picador Press. Well, Mary Costello, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me, Francesca.
This book, Academy Street, I just found to be a luminous novel, a word I don't often use. It was profoundly moving, and I think one reason was that it so much illuminates the inner life of a character that seems so disconnected to how others perceive her.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that was something that you set out to do and why. What so interested you about that disconnect between the outer life and the inner life of this character?
It wasn't so much something I set out to do. I really set out to write a woman's life, a woman who's very introverted and fairly quiet, but it doesn't mean she is passive. You know, I consider Tess to have a very vibrant inner life. She doesn't always mediate the outer world very well. And I think that's what you're saying, that there's a huge disconnect between the inner and the outer worlds and the inner and the outer lives. I had her in my mind for some time, and I am always interested in characters where the inner life is rich, the interior, where they have an interior life that is richer maybe than the exterior life. Characters who have a very extroverted life in fiction or in life don't interest me as much, to be honest. Tess really lives between the two in a way. You know, she has to function in the outer life, and she does. You know, she decides to immigrate to America. She decides to keep her child when she falls pregnant. She lives a full life as a nurse and a mother. pays her rent and everything, sometimes people say to me that they don't like her passiveness, and I never consider that she isn't proactive. But the truth is, she lives a very full life and functions well in the world. But all along, she has some fears, and she has an interior bent, if you like, which makes it harder for her to navigate the world. I think she's one of these people who finds it hard to mediate the external everyday world.
And does that begin as a child, when as a child she experiences the death of her mother?
Yes, to some extent that's true. The death of her mother is a formative experience. However, when we encounter Tess at the very beginning of the novel, it's 1944 and Tess is 7. And she's just lost her mother. But she already has this character. She already has this nature, this quiet, sensitive, shy nature. She's hyper alert to the world around her, to the physical world and to the people around her, especially the physical world. I think that there are moments when she can almost hear the grass growing or hear the pebbles laughing. So when we encounter her mother has just died, so this is already her nature. She's already, you know, 7 years old, and she hasn't until this moment suffered the trauma of her mother. So I think Tess was born with this nature to some extent. She was born as an introverted, intuitive type. There's no doubt about it that her mother's death had a bearing on her life, especially later on. I think what a good enough mother or a good enough parent or a good enough guardian, it can be a mother, father, or two mothers or whatever, grandmother, two fathers, whatever. Winnicott, Donald Winnicott, the early 20th century child psychologist, coined the phrase good enough mother. Of course, we have to say good enough parent nowadays, or guardian. And what he meant was that you don't need to be extraordinary to mediate the world for a child and to make it safe. And I think what happens to Tess is that she loses her mother at a critical time, and a good enough parent or mother or older sister or grandmother or father would have mediated the outer world and not made it so fearful. Tess grows up with quite a lot of fears around the world, and I think some of those were exacerbated by the death of her mother. There's no doubt that her inherent nature lends itself to fear, fearfulness in the outer world, but the loss of her mother certainly probably caused some of the fears. She was unable to mediate, I think, the external world as safely as she might have been had her mother survived.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist and short story writer Mary Costello about her debut novel, Academy Street. Before we go any further, I should ask you, where did this story come from?
I think I mentioned that I write short stories, and in my first collection I had a story called You Fill Up My Senses. It's actually after the John Denver song. And there's a little girl there who is very attached to her mother, and her mother comes from a big old house called Easterfield, and that was the very beginning of it. And I had this girl growing up in a big old house in the 40s, and it was inspired a little bit by my mother's home. My mother grew up in a big old house in the west of Ireland, just like Easterfield. I modelled Easterfield on it. And I remember the house when I was a child. We used to go to visit there. It had a long avenue into it, and it had two stairs and lovely big drawing room and, you know, an orchard and coach houses. It was not in good condition at that stage, and it had originally been a landlord's house. It was several hundred years old, and it had belonged to a big estate. And my grandfather and the family bought it in 1911. So that's how my mother happened to be off that house. When she was three in 1942, her mother died suddenly. And she had a younger brother, and she had older sisters who were in boarding school in the local, in Tuam in County Galway. And when I was a child growing up, I was very close to my own mother. I'm the eldest girl, and I was in that sort of a way that you can sometimes, as children sometimes are with their mothers. It was almost like I was in love with her, you know, very close to her. And at some stage early on, when I was quite young, I became aware that she had lost her mother when she was a child. And I found that really hard to imagine. You know, I would look at her and think, you had no mother. And later on then, when I became an adult, I began to think about the catastrophic effects that the death of a parent, in particular the death of a mother, can have on a whole family, and how the trajectory of that family can change drastically. My mother's older sisters were all away in boarding school. You know, there was no state school in Ireland in the 40s and 50s, so they were in boarding school. And when their mother died, they were taken out to mind the younger ones, and they never returned. And they would have been destined for university, I think, and they didn't go. And I often thought, as a young woman myself, you know, what are the knock-on effects? My mother didn't go to university. And I wondered, what is the impact down the line, even in generations, when something like that happens? So that was originally the spur, you know, the big old house, which I remember, my mother's own childhood. And of course, so Tess, while Tess has, you know, some biographical similarities to my mother's life and to my aunt, an aunt of mine went to America and became a nurse, she's an entirely invented character. My mother never immigrated, but two of her sisters and a brother did. They went to New York in the early 1960s. One of them, my Aunt Carmel, was a nurse. She trained as a nurse in Dublin, and she went to nurse in New York for about 4 years. She came back and settled in the west of Ireland again, but I keep Tess. When I was a child, my Aunt Carmel, who's in her 80s now, I would often ask her about New York, and so I had this image. And also we used to get home photographs of other aunts and uncles in America, and they always looked beautiful, you know. My aunts and uncles in the 60s, they seemed to have lovely dresses, and the men wore suits, and, you know, their satin, the women wore satin dresses, and they looked beautiful, and they looked as if they were going to, I don't know, a party or a ball on the Upper West Side. Of course, they were probably just going to a Cayley in the Bronx, you know, an Irish dance in the Bronx. To me, they looked very glamorous, and I thought, this is what America does. It makes people beautiful. And I think a lot of children, especially Irish children, have that love affair with New York. So I imagined Tess's life from those sort of scraps that I had from, you know, little things would come to light. And also that generation of Irish immigrants, you know, my parents' generation, young men and women who went out in the 60s, 50s and 60s to America, they had come from a very Catholic, very traditional country. They were young and hopeful with a lot of dreams. And, you know, they would have gone to mass every Sunday, and they'd have lived quite chaste lives. You know, they weren't part of the counterculture unfolding in America in the 60s, certainly. And when I see them in photographs, you know, and, you know, when I think of their lives, I think there's something very earnest and sincere and completely lacking in cynicism about their lives. You know, something hopeful as well. And of course, a lot of their dreams and hopes didn't come true.
Before, Costello mentioned Winnicott, the psychologist who wrote about good enough mothering.
Winnicott spoke a lot about attachment, you know, the development of attachment, and how such a loss, although he often, I believe he connected it to the first 3 years of life, but to a failure to attach, to be attachment disorder. Is this some of what happens with Tess? I mean, she does seem to attach quite well to her son. She becomes a single parent, but he has, when he pulls away from her as an adolescent, there is definitely a disconnect between them. So I wonder if he reflects some inability to attach on her part.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that an inability to attach or a failure to attach is an aspect of Tess's life. I think she has a beautiful, loving relationship with her mother and her sister Claire, and, you know, the farmhand Mike Connolly, and even her father to a large extent. And she's very capable of loving. You know, she's a rich friendship with her friend Willa, and as you say, she had a deep love, perhaps an overwhelming love for her son Theo. So I don't think failure to attach is an issue for Tess. I think the manner in which she loves an all-consuming kind of love, which, you know, in its more pejorative way might be called a smother mother to her son, you know, where she showers him and doesn't establish a safer, more robust relationship with him. And that isn't that surprising as well. And I think that Theo's relationship with his mother comes right to some extent in adulthood, but his pulling away in teenage years is quite normal. I had two brothers, and in teenage years, and in fact, even with myself and my sisters, you do tend to rebel against parents. So it isn't that unusual. The thing about Tessa's relationship with Theo is that there is no other figure. There is no other, whether it's a father figure or a grandparent figure or whatever, there is no other figure. So her love of him is intense and perhaps overpowering at times, and quite maybe too much for him. So some people say to me, oh, why did you do this? Why couldn't she at least have a really good, strong, beautiful relationship with Theo? Well, the fact is, this happens all the time. You know, this is life. Teenage boys or teenagers do have difficult relationships, and especially when there isn't a father figure. That was how it was. And especially with, I think, Tess's kind of loving. There is an earlier section, Tess sees a photograph of David, the man with whom she fell in love briefly after getting to America, the father of her child. And she sees that he's remarried, and there is a woman, his new wife. She sees a photograph of them in the paper, and she's somewhat grateful to this woman, because she sees in her eyes that this woman would love him properly, not love him the way Tess would, wanting to know the very source of him. And I think that's the kind of love, it might be regarded as faulty love, but it's an all-consuming love that Tess is capable of.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with short story writer and novelist Mary Costello about her debut novel, Academy Street.
It's almost as if you're saying that someone so introverted as Tess is has an intensity of experience that is so great that it does overwhelm her relationships.
Yes, I think that is a good way of putting it. Tess does feel extremely, you know, you obviously, one might not see this from her external life or her demeanor in many ways, but she's constantly yearning for some layer beyond external reality. She's straining towards something, trying to put her finger on some higher note, maybe something divine, sublime. And it's something as well, maybe to do with that loss of paradise that she sometimes hankers after from her childhood. Towards the end, when she returns to the big old house she grew up in the west of Ireland, she momentarily thinks she has returned to lost paradise, Eden, if you like. But she soon realizes that there is no Eden. And I think that a lot of people strain, have that hankering after something higher. They have a perpetual ache to touch some higher note, as I said. It, for some people, of course, faith or religion answers that need. For some, it's art. And for Tess, for a while, she felt that. She got a glimpse of that through books and through love, through the love of David for a while and her son, through her friendship with Willa, but especially through books later in her life when she discovers books.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. Why books? What do books do for her?
Well, I suppose with any reader, especially for a woman like Tess, who is an introvert, and when I use the word introvert, sometimes it is people mistake it for just being very quiet, you know. But in Jungi, I think it was Carl Jung that, you know, made that distinction between introverts and extroverts. And his idea was that an introvert gets their energy from within. You know, they get the energy all their sense of who they are and their sense of creativity and a sense of rightness from the interior life. They don't necessarily get fulfillment in the exterior life. Of course, everybody has to function in the external world, so you have to live between both. But an introvert gets the real important, significant energy and fulfillment and reason to live from within. And of course, anybody who reads is going to have the imagination and the interior life prompted and fed and nourished all the time. So it is no surprise that Tess finds some kind of redemption, some kind of feeling of rightness in books and poetry. It's where she can dwell. It's where a lot of people who read dwell, find, if you like, some kind of meaning, certainly some kind of a feeling of rightness.
I feel like you're describing me.
I know.
And in fact, I did feel a very strong connection to your character, to Tess, also in the sense that the inner life and the sense that one takes one's meaning and value as a person from how one's inner life is imagined and created. But it's not just inner without connection to the world. I mean, she has a sense of, it's how she does confront the world from the inside out that is important.
Thank you for that. That's a really good insight, because not everybody gets that. I've had people, as I said, find her too passive and submissive. But of course, as you said, she does confront the outer world. She does get her meaning and value as a person, as you say, from her inner life, but is also connected to the outer world. But I think her inner life comes first. One of the things that I was aware of as I was writing it is the issue of fate, F-A-T-E, and how Tess is very aware of how precarious life is to some extent, and how she may often float close to hazard, how we all float close to hazard. In fact, we're only a breath away from death, really, and the miracle is that we survive at all. And I think someone like Tess is hypersensitive to that sort of an existence, and she's aware that almost that there are other forces that she cannot quite put her finger on at work. Not in any weird sort of way, but it's a sort of a spiritual awareness of the unity of things and how everything matters, how every... Tess lives very much in the present. She does think about the past, of course, and she has lots of fears, but we're with her a lot of the time. And I think this was evident a lot more in the childhood section. I remember when I was writing this, I was very aware of writing it as a child that is hyper alert to the world around her. And all children, in a way, live very much in the present. They don't have any forethought of the future very much. Young child of 6 or 7, they don't think about the past much. They live very much out of their senses in a way like an animal does in a way. They live, they're aware that they're hungry or thirsty or they need to pee or there's a stone in their shoe. They live very much of the present in each moment unfolding. And when I was writing Tess as a child, I felt just compelled to keep very close, up close, right up close to her, so that the moment of reality was unfolding with her senses. I was experiencing Tess up close through all her sensory faculties. So everything happened in that moment. And even later on in life, I suppose, that was my sense of Tess, that she was living fully, all cylinders firing from an interior point, certainly, and even in the external world. And even when things went wrong, I had this idea towards the end of the book. I didn't think of it at the time, but after I had done a reading one time, someone said, Tess is a very sad person. And I never considered her sad when I was writing her at all. I never considered her passive or submissive or sad, because to me she had a turbulent inner life and a very full inner life. But what struck me was that I started to think then about her life, looking back on her life, and she had, of course, encountered trials, but over the whole course of her life, they are not that unusual. You know, in any person's life, a parent can be lost. You know, by the time she's an old woman, she suffers further tragedies, but in and of itself, she didn't have bad health, you know. In and of itself, it's not that extraordinary what she has endured. And I began to think, how would Tess herself view her life if she were to look back? And I think she would say that nothing is wasted. Even when things go terribly wrong, even when love ends up in a calamity, you know, she experiences calamitous love, if you like, even when there's loss, everything counts. And especially with love, and Tess certainly has loved. So nothing is wasted, and the heart is always enlarged. So then I never think of Tess as having been sad, because I think of her as being a person who grew. And that yearning towards what I mentioned earlier, trying to put her finger in a higher note, that yearning towards something sublime or divine, maybe, or numinous, I think, in its simplest terms, what it means is that she's yearning for consciousness. It's a constant, life is a journey towards consciousness or greater consciousness, that every single thing is an opportunity to expand consciousness. And I didn't think of that, of course, at all when I was writing Tess. It's only afterwards when I began to think, how would she view her life, you know? And I think she would say nothing is wasted, because the heart is always enlarged.
Yes, I mean, I actually found her life to be a kind of triumph. I mean, you span six decades in this book. She really grows as a character. She changes, and it's almost, yeah, that she really accomplishes, I think, you know, she becomes a successful person in a way that most people who would look at her, I guess, from the outside wouldn't even see. I mean, one reviewer called your book A Study in Narcissism, and I thought about that. I thought, how did he get narcissism? You know, my sense is that she really does become a successful human being in all the senses that actually count, her sense of her sensibility about the world, her sense of what is important in the relationships that people have, and her response to the things that happen to her. And also she goes back home, ultimately. She goes back to her family on a visit, and that bookends the book, that ends the book, just as kind of the loss of her mother begins it, the recovery of her family ends it. And so I wonder if you could say something about that.
Yes, I suppose I hadn't known that she would return, but it became obvious as I neared the ending that it would have been somewhat odd if she hadn't made one trip back anyway. It wasn't unusual, of course, for people to immigrate, especially when she became a single mother, because it would have been regarded as socially unacceptable to have a child outside of wedlock, certainly in Ireland in the 60s. But the place she came from, the big house and the farm called Easterfield, had a very big effect on her in her childhood. It would have been, I think, remiss of me somehow. I wouldn't have felt right to not return her there, because she is the kind of person who would have wanted to make that journey. And because of its landscape, because of the history of the house in particular, and what Tess discovered about it growing up, that it had once been a hospital during the Irish famine in the 1840s, before her family came into possession of it. And she discovers as a young girl that during the famine it had opened, as I said, as a relief hospital when people were dying of starvation due to the failure of the potato crop. 1 million people died in Ireland in the late 1840s. And Tess's house, Tess's home, a big old house, had been used as a relief hospital to help overcrowding in the local hospital. And many people died. And she read about it afterwards and discovered that people had been buried in the fields, in the ditches, in the quarry where she had played. And all of that, I think, left a mark in her, on her psyche anyway. I think, you know, I've never been to Auschwitz or Belsen or in those places or any place which has a very dark history, but people say that the landscape retains the memory. It's like muscle memory in our bodies, that a tragic and terrible catastrophe on the land is felt by the earth. And Tess is certainly the kind of person who would be sensitive to that sort of an inheritance on the land. And I think that the imprint of that landscape that she grew up in and that house left its a mark on her soul, in a way, you know. The place imprinted itself on her psyche and her soul. So a return was inevitable, I think.
I can attest to the fact that landscapes of great torment retain that sense. It was palpable when I went to visit Buchenwald.
Right.
Well, it's such a powerful book. Thank you so much, Mary Costello. Your wonderful novel is Academy Street. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca, for saying such kind things about it, too. Thank you.
Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Mary Costello's novel, Academy Street. Next up, Katha Pollitt on abortion rights. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On June 27th, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Texas law that severely restricted access to abortion clinics. The law required clinics to conform to onerous hospital operating room standards instead of outpatient clinic standards that are widely recognized to be safe. The Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional, thereby calling similar laws in other states into question. Maybe some of the justices read Katha Pollitt's 2015 book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. We spoke with Pollitt about the book in February of 2015. Here's a replay of that conversation.
Katha Pollitt, welcome to Writer's Voice. In Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. First of all, I have to say I was thrilled to read this book. It felt like a clarion call to finally saying the things that so many pro-choice people have been afraid to say for so many years. You say you wrote the book because you wanted to put women back into the center of the abortion debate. We're not at the center?
No, I think they've been nudged off stage by the, quote, fetus, unquote, the unborn. They never say fertilized egg. They never say embryo, although most abortions are actually of embryos. It's always the fetus or the unborn child. And that's mostly what the debate and discussion revolves around.
And yet, I'm old enough to remember before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was just legal in certain states, but not the law of the land. At that time, it seems to me women were at the center of it. In fact, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women.
Yes, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women. And the women's movement at that time was very, very clear about this was a question of women's health, women's lives, women's ability to lead the kind of life that they chose. It was about poverty. It was about all kinds of things, but it was not about the life of the unborn. That issue was for women to think about privately. And if they thought it was wrong to have an abortion, they shouldn't have one.
You actually say that this construction, however, the construction of abortion that Roe versus Wade, the way it framed it as a right to privacy, was not the best way to frame it. And you frame it differently. You frame it as an issue of equality. Could you talk about what's the difference between privacy and equality in terms of the implications for the right to legal abortions?
I think I don't put it as strongly as you do, the point about privacy and equality. The Roe versus Wade makes the privacy argument, and many people have said, oh, it would have been better if Justice Blackmun had based the right to an abortion on women's equality, that being able to control your childbearing is essential for women to be in the workforce and to, you know, be equal to men. I think there's a lot to be said for that point of view, although I think privacy is also important. I don't see why it couldn't have had two reasons, you know. And he was presented with the equality argument. There were amicus briefs that made that argument, and he picked privacy. And I think he picked privacy because if you read Roe v. Wade, it's very focused on doctors and their rights and on health, and that the privacy argument fits in better with that kind of a framework. But I think that without the right to control your body, you really don't have very many rights at all. At any moment, you can get pregnant, and then at that moment, your entire life is turned upside down. Whether you had voluntary sex, involuntary sex, whatever your state of health, however old you are, all the rest, none of that matters. You're pregnant, so that's what matters. That's a very, very large burden for women and only women to bear as they go through life. What I say in my book, though, is some people say the outcome for abortion rights would have been very different had Roe v. Wade based its argument for legal abortion on equality rather than privacy. And that's what I wonder about, because the anti-abortion movement, I think, would have developed just the same, you know? And the same people who have a problem with privacy for women have a problem with equality for women. And so I don't think it would have been any different in the long run. I think the actual words of Roe v. Wade and the actual arguments of Roe v. Wade matter a lot less than what Roe v. Wade did.
But at least it would have kept the woman at the center of the debate. And one of the things that you do in your book, Katha Pollitt, that you do in Pro, is to show how the pro-choice movement itself has become apologetic about the demands for access to abortion. I wonder if you could talk about how this debate has shifted, how the frame has shifted, and how those who are pro-choice have shifted along with it, and what that has done to the movement, to cede ground to the anti-abortionists.
Right. Well, I would say that when abortion was first legalized, and the emphasis was on women, you found people saying, you know, a popular slogan was abortion on demand and without apology. That framework of not just I have the right to control my body, but I have the right to lead the life I want to lead, and a stray sperm should not get in the way of that. That framework has been replaced by a much more apologetic one, which is, oh, abortion is just, it should be safe, legal, and rare, which was the Clinton mantra. Abortion is, oh, it's the most difficult decision a woman ever makes. And I'm thinking, really? A woman who had no thought or interest in having a baby gets pregnant, and all of a sudden she's seriously thinking to herself, oh, I really should have this baby, but I don't think that's the way it works. And I think that what that framework is about, this new one, is it's trying to placate the growing sense that there's something deeply wrong about abortion, and it has to be legal because women will die if they have to seek illegal procedures. But it's really a terrible thing, and women should feel really bad about it. I think it's an acceptance of stigma.
In fact, you say we need to treat abortion not as rare, but as common. How common is abortion?
Well, abortion is very common, although the number of abortions has been declining for quite some time. But the statistic you often hear is that 1 in 3 women will have had at least one abortion by menopause. And even if the abortion rate goes down and it turns out to be, okay, 1 in 4, that's still a lot of people.
So it's this common, and I can come out and say right now that I'm one of those 1 in 3. In fact, I'm surprised it's not higher. But I think women tend to be quite secret about the numbers of abortions that they have. I wonder if you could talk about that, you know, the pressure to keep this secret.
It's so true. It is just so true. Now, interestingly, my book got a lot of reviews, and in 3 of them, the author said, I had an abortion. And in one of those cases, that woman hadn't told anybody. And I think it is very hard for women to talk about their abortions. And my hope is that the book will encourage people to do that. If you can do that, if you're in a safe place where you can do that, you'd really be helping a lot of women. Because since women tend not to talk about this, even sometimes with their closest friends, even with their husbands, then the perception is never challenged that abortion is not just not all that common, but that the people who have abortions, this is important, the people who have abortions are the stereotypical, teenager running wild, the slutty co-ed, 20-somethings who are just selfish and want to have fun, and the most popular one of all, the cold-hearted career woman who hates children. And so there's a perception that, the people who have abortions aren't people like me, an upstanding Christian or a decent person or the mother of several children. And I'll just say by way of parenthesis that now, these days, most women who have abortions are already mothers, which tells you something right there about how these stereotypes don't fit reality.
The stigma that is attendant on it, you turn that around and say not only is it not immoral to have an abortion, but often it is the moral decision. Could you
I think that's
it.
Really true. I support women, women making their own decision, whatever they do, but I think that there's just no question that it's good to have children when you're in a good place to take care of them. It's not a good idea to have 10 children that you can't pay proper attention to. And it's not a good idea to have children when you're too young or when you need your education or when you already have several children. A lot of women have children that are disabled and their hands are totally full taking care of those children. I think a lot of women have abortions because they're thinking about the children they already have and what those children need and how much the woman has to give to them.
Right. That was certainly true in my case. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the anti-abortion movement. Their policy has been to restrict more and more, to chip away at the rights granted by Roe versus Wade. Talk about the changes in the landscape of access to abortion that has been going on for the last 30 years, and where are we right now?
Well, I'm sure your listeners know that in the last couple of years, there have been a tremendous number of laws passed in the states restricting access to abortion. Over 200 in the last 2 years. And this is all related to Republican success in the states and in controlling state legislatures and governorships. And that's why we've seen, for example, you know, so many clinics closed in Texas, and why there is only one abortion clinic left in Missouri, which is a big state, and where they've just passed a 72-hour waiting period. Clinics have closed in Ohio, in Virginia, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania. You know, I think for a long time people thought, oh, okay, it's North Dakota and South Dakota that, you know, they'd each only have one clinic left, that the success of the pro-life movement has been limited to low population rural states that are far away from most of the rest of America. But to the extent that it ever was true, it's not true anymore. Now we're seeing that it isn't just in red states where clinics are closing. It's in some pretty purple states, too. So the combination of clinics closing as a result of what are called trap laws, targeted regulation of abortion providers, these are the laws that will typically require a clinic to renovate or remodel in ways that have no bearing on their ability to provide services, but that are very expensive. And that's a way of shutting them down. If you make a clinic do $1 million worth of architectural changes, and also this requirement that doctors have admitting privileges within, you know, 30 miles of the clinic, but then no hospital will give them those admitting privileges. So that's another way of shutting them down. So between the trap laws and the ever-increasing restrictions, it's much harder to get an abortion in much of the country than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Katha Pollitt about her new book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Now, just a little point. I noticed that although in the book you do clarify the issue of what to call the anti-abortion movement, you just referred to them as pro-life.
Right. I use the word pro-life when I'm talking about the political movement that calls itself pro-life. But I try to avoid using that word to describe the ideas of that movement or the individuals. And I try to call them abortion opponents, anti-abortion, words like that, because I don't think they are pro-life. I think that's a propaganda word.
There's one example in the book where they cut support to children who are already born in order to fund these clinics, so-called clinics that
right.
are pushing women.
To fund the crisis pregnancy centers, right. That happens. There's been a big transfer of wealth away from born children to fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses. And who thinks that's a good idea?
And so talking about fetuses and embryos, you have a marvelous chapter in the book about what is a person. Talk about that within the context of, you know, what is a person and then is a woman a person? I think to link those two ideas together.
Well, anti-choicers, of course, base a lot on the personhood, the supposed personhood of the fertilized egg, embryo, and fetus. And I look at, well, what do we mean when we say something is someone is a person? We don't mean that they're some DNA, you know. We mean things like they have consciousness, they have arms and legs and a head, they have social relationships, they have all the qualities, or at least some of the qualities that a born person has that a fertilized egg, for example, does not have. And you can see how this language of personhood, it's very iffy, because the fertilized egg in a woman, it's a person. Even before it's implanted, from the moment of conception, it's a person. But that same fertilized egg in a petri dish, in a fertility clinic, that's not a person. And although there are some anti-abortion people who would say, no, it's a person when it's in the petri dish too, that's never going to get anywhere because we love fertility medicine in America. That's all about making babies. So if you have to destroy a whole bunch of fertilized eggs and pre-embryos to achieve that worthy goal, that's fine. Fertility doctors don't have to go to work in bulletproof vests. But that just shows you that it's really about women. It's really about women, and it's about sex. That's how that fertilized egg got in that woman is very important.
Say more about that. Yeah. What do you mean it's about sex? I mean, it's not just about sex, oh, we love sex. It's about sex in a very different way.
Right. Well, you can see this, too. Most Americans, the very, very large majority of Americans, would say that to have an abortion if you're raped is okay. But to have an abortion when you had voluntary sex, unless there's a serious health problem, is not okay. Well, why is that? From the point of view of the embryo, if an embryo can be said to have a point of view, it's just the same. And yet, for most people, it feels quite different. It's as if they think sex is a kind of contract to have a baby if a baby is started. What a lot of people are very disturbed by the separation of sex and reproduction. That just seems like that's where it all went wrong, when people just, you know, all this hedonism, all this wild 60s stuff, people just doing what they want. It's all bad.
But only having to do with women, I mean, I haven't seen anything about trying to control the sexuality of men.
Well, that's true. And you do wonder, well, how would that be done, right? I mean, how would that happen? They would say, well, he has to pay child support. But child support is nothing like having to risk your health and life and your social position and all your hopes and dreams in pregnancy and childbirth. There's just no comparison there. And it's also the woman, too, has to pay child support to herself, right? I mean, there aren't that many men who are bearing the full 50% cost of raising a child to adulthood. And there are many, many who pay nothing. So it's about controlling women's sexuality. And I do think that that is what a lot of the anti-abortion movement is all about.
Do you actually say the aim is really not just to make abortion illegal? In fact, that the agenda goes far beyond that, and it's really not even about that.
Well, yeah, birth control. I mean, this is a really fascinating thing. When pro-choicers started saying, you know, they're coming for your birth control too, this was widely poo-pooed in the mainstream media, sort of like, oh, these pro-choicers, they're always such hysterics. You know, it's always Chicken Little with the sky falling. But, you know, time passes, and now you can see it's really true. When all this defunding of Planned Parenthood means less access to birth control, flat funding for Title X, which is the federal program that provides birth control to poor women. And then a very interesting feature is the way more and more the pro-life movement is trying to make a case that birth control is actually a form of abortion. So, for example, emergency contraception causes an abortion, which is not true. It prevents ovulation. It will not interfere with an established pregnancy, and it doesn't even, apparently, prevent implantation. It prevents ovulation. But they don't accept that science. They have their own facts. The birth control pill, more abortion. The IUD, abortion. And I'm thinking, why aren't they happy that the vast majority of studies and science and medicine say these things are not abortions? Why aren't they saying, well, this is great. Here's the wonderful compromise. We're against abortion, but we love birth control. But they don't say that. They say we're against abortion, and birth control is another form of abortion. So that's where you can see that there's a real anti-women sexuality component in all this.
You know, this puts me in mind of The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's prescient novel. And yet, even with all that we've been talking about, the legal right to abortion still remains in the polls, overwhelmingly supported by the American people. Do we risk getting to The Handmaid's Tale or something like that? Your book is aimed at the muddled middle, you say. I mean, obviously, people like myself and like you are very clear about the necessity of keeping abortion legal. What has to happen to really build a movement that can support the rights that a vast majority of American women and men support?
Well, I don't think we're going to end up with the Handmaid's Tale version of life. I think women have come much too far to be turned back and confined in that way. I think we might see abortion not available in a lot of red states and in a lot of areas in blue states. But there are states where abortion rights are very popular. For example, New York and California. But we might see that abortion, you can't get an abortion in the middle of the country. You know, you can get an abortion on the coasts and maybe a few big cities in between, like Chicago. But basically, it will be very hard to get. And I could also see abortion being made much harder to get than it already is after the first trimester, because these polls depend a lot on how you ask the question. If you ask the question, do you agree with the Roe v. Wade decision, which made abortion legal through most of pregnancy, people will say, yes, I agree with that. But if you ask them, you know, well, what about abortion in the second trimester? That support falls way off. What about abortion in the third trimester? Almost nobody's in favor of that. And one of the things I talk about in my book is people don't really know what all these things mean. Like, they don't know that it's, you know, there are like three places in the whole country where you can get a third trimester abortion, and which are usually for pretty serious reasons. Now, you ask about how can we have a strong pro-choice movement. And I would say, you know, my hope is that it's already starting. I think with the youngest cohort of activists, we are seeing a vigor and energy and in-your-faceness that is something quite fresh. And that's really great. For example, you see women tweeting their abortions, filming their abortions, refusing to accept that whole stigmatized framework. You see new organizations that are fighting stigma, which I think is an essential step. You know, you're not going to get people mobilized around this issue as long as they feel ashamed of what they've done. So there's a new organization called Sea Change that organizes book clubs to discuss an anthology that they've put together of stories about all aspects of reproduction written by all sorts of women. And then the women in the book club talk about it. And what often comes out is how many of them have had abortions and how they feel about it. And that's huge.
Well, Kath Hippolyte, I want to thank you so much for writing this book. It's actually a terrific read. It's called Pro, and thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Kath Hippolyte. You can read an excerpt to Pro by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.